The sacrifices and disciplines of the path have no terrors for them, all they pray for is opportunity. But in very many cases these souls are not free to take the opportunity that offers, they are bound by the chains of duty or of circumstances. Unless they are prepared to disregard the rights and welfare of others, they cannot set foot upon the path. Is it to be considered right to sacrifice others to the service of the masters? Which is the higher duty, the service of the masters or the service of the family and home? This is a big question, and one that is constantly recurring, and its answer is not as simple as some would have us think. When a soul thus spontaneously answers to the call of the path, it is obvious that it is not hearing it for the first time. In past lives it has passed within the veil of the temple and the memory is latent in the subconscious mind. This being the case, why should it be that when the call comes in this life it should not be free to follow it without breaking faith and neglecting sacred ties? It is to the law of karma that we have to look for an answer to this question. There must be something in the karma that has to be worked out before that soul is ready for the path, and the bonds of obligations are laid upon it in order that they may be its discipline. The way which such a soul is destined to follow is known as the path of the hearth fire, and is as true a way of initiation as any of the disciplines imposed by the occult fraternities. Neither is it a quicker or slower way of initiation than any other. A builder may spend much time in gathering together the materials of the house he intends to build. He may fashion those materials section by section and spend days and weeks at the work, and yet no wall begins to rise. Then, after much careful and accurate work, he comes to the stage when he is ready to assemble the parts he has so laboriously constructed, and in a few hours the perfectly matched sections are bolted together and the structure is up. So it is with the preparation for initiation. The candidate may spend long years in the preliminary training, disciplining mind and body, learning all the lessons of life, loosening his hold on the desires and dreams of matter, and patiently waiting for the longed-for admission to the mysteries, and then, after the long and weary task has been fulfilled, and he comes, perhaps in the evening of his days, to the opportunity so long foregone, he will find that the weary years of patient bearing of burdens have taken his consciousness through many degrees of discipline and initiation, and that when he comes to the mysteries, he will pass rapidly through the outer court and find himself admitted to the temple. If life has taught him the lessons of occult discipline, the lesser initiator has no need to teach them to him, but, having tested him to prove his experience, vouches for him to the great initiator. A certain stage of experience has got to be reached before we are ready for initiation. The bonds of the senses must have begun to loosen of their own accord before we are ready for the great renunciation of a personal sense of life. There are three initiators who bring us to the altar of the mysteries: the great initiator, who is the master, the lesser initiator, who is the teacher, and our own higher self, which trains us by means of the lessons of life and the realizations they bring. The discipline of the path cannot be learned from books, it is experience alone which brings realization. Let therefore accept our karma as the first initiation. Let us strive for a mastery of ourselves and our circumstances which shall give us serenity under all conditions. What cannot be cured must be endured. This is the first lesson which karma teaches us. The adept is a man of unruffled serenity, for he is a man of perfect self-control. Let us strive for mastery of the inner astral kingdom of the emotions. Once we have acquired this, we have the key of the astral plane in our hand, ready for the time when the initiator shall bring us to the door. On the other hand, it is our bounden duty, as knights of God, to resist injustice and enforce the law of harmony in whatever sphere it may please God to place us. Whatsoever thy hand findeth to do, do it with all thy might. What can be cured should not be endured if human courage and ingenuity can mend it. We should neither sit supinely down under remediable evil nor keep up a perpetual whine about the irremediable. We should either accept willingly and cheerfully, or reject courageously and determinedly. If we live our daily life according to cosmic principles, we shall work out whatever karma has been given us for our portion in this incarnation and win our freedom. Out of the experience thus gained comes the preparation of the soul and rapid advancement in the mysteries when once the right of entrance has been gained. Then are several causes which bind us in chains of duty to personalities and to the humdrum task of life when our whole soul desires to serve the masters and combat spiritual wickedness in high places. We may have failed in certain of our tests in a past life, and therefore have to take those tests over again. We can see examples of this around us every day. A student may have taken all the subjects of his degree with brilliance, but because he has failed in one of the subjects of a preliminary examination, may not be entitled to his certificate. He has to sit for the preliminary work again, and may possibly fail repeatedly before some elementary paper in mathematics or languages is properly worked. So it often is with the soul in which we see the lofty aspirations but who is yet bound to mundane duties. That soul is in all probability completing some of the elementary lessons so essential to success in the tasks of applied occultism. As soon as these tests are passed, he will be eligible for the degree whose higher work he has already completed. Again, it sometimes happens that souls which have advanced far into the mysteries turn back at the call of human love and forge anew the chains of karmic ties. In subsequent lives the debts thus incurred must be discharged. Sometimes the turning aside is motivated by the passions and the senses, sometimes a higher motive determines the choice, and out of pure pity a soul that is traveling fast may turn back to hold out a hand to a beloved one who is progressing more slowly. It is seldom possible to judge of the wisdom of a decision taken in a past life, but its obligations remain to be met. And if the choice of pity and patience has been made, it must be abided by cheerfully and willingly if its good karma is to be reaped. It is not enough, however, to recognize that a bondage to the duties of the home may be a karmic debt, nor yet to realize that it is indeed a path to the light. If the home is to become a temple of initiation for the soul, its duties must be worked as a ritual. As long as we hate the humble duties of the home, even if we perform them faithfully, that home cannot be a temple, and if we perform them badly, we fail to initiate, and that, as every student of occultism knows, is a very serious thing for the candidate. In order to make the home a temple of initiation for the soul, its duties must be dominated by two ideals, love and beauty. Its services must be rendered with sympathy and joy, and we must make its humblest details beautiful. Even in the barest room there is a beauty of perfect cleanliness and order. If we would merely eliminate the superfluous from our homes and keep what remains in perfect order, we should have achieved true beauty, as many a bare convent refectory can show. If our home problems prove very difficult, let us, in imagination, always put a chair at the fireside and lay a place at table for the unseen guest, and live our life and do our work in the light of that invisible presence. If we rule our homes in a spirit of selfless love and serenity of heart, asking no return, but doing our duty for the sake of the need of those to whom we minister, our house will be a true temple of the hearth fire in which we can receive our initiation. Let us try to keep our homes always in readiness for the coming of the wayfaring Christ, who, as the old story has it, goes up and down among men saying, "The foxes of the earth have holes, and the birds of the air have nests. But the Son of Man has not where to lay his head." For his coming it is not enough that the house should be swept and garnished, the spirit of the home must blossom on the hearth in peace and goodwill and, above all, in serenity, which is the true keynote of home. Chapter 6, Daily Life Upon the Path. The rule of the path is not a written code that demands an outer conformity, but a dedication to an ideal, and involves self-discipline in order that the ideal may be attained. Those who follow the path, whether they be leading a community life or following community ideals out in the world, learn certain spiritual principles which, as underlying cosmic laws, govern all things. No rules are made concerning the application of these principles to the affairs of life. Each student applies them to his own circumstances and problems according to his understanding. Counsel is not proffered unless it is asked. For until the need for guidance has been realized, guidance is seldom acceptable. It is of more value that a soul should learn than that it should do the right thing. If the cosmic laws are obeyed, results are obtained. If they are disregarded, they follow the inevitable consequences of a broken natural law. The growth of the soul takes place through many incarnations, and different attainments are required of it at different stages of its development. Therefore, no objective standard of achievement is set. A principle is taught, an ideal upheld, and each student is counseled to apply that principle and follow that ideal in the circumstances in which he finds himself. For it is only as he is faithful over few things that he will be entrusted with many. The principle is the same whether it be applied to the ordering of a cottage or a palace, and if that principle be realized and faithfully applied in the cottage, it can speedily be adapted to the palace. The person who makes a model on a small scale is hardly likely to succeed if entrusted with work on a large scale. The first principle to be learned concerns the nature of the cosmic laws and their inviolability. Students must accept the concept of the absolute rule of law that nothing is fortuitous, accidental or incidental. Whatever happens is the result of a cause, whatever is going to happen is also the result of a cause. Being aware of this law, the initiate never grumbles or repines, but accepts calmly and unresentfully whatever may befall him, knowing that nothing comes to him which is not his due. Acknowledging the justice of karma, he accepts the reactions of the past ungrudgingly. It is this serene and cheerful acceptance by which the initiate can always be known. His one care is to keep in tune with the cosmic harmony, and whether he bow his head to study his lesson or lift it to sing and rejoice, his face never loses its serenity. When reincarnation is held as a fact of experience, the attitude towards human problems differs profoundly from that which prevails when it is believed that all problems begin and end in this, the present life. The initiate may accept his lot with a calmness which amazes men whose impulse it is to curse or pray according to their nature, but his acceptance does not necessarily imply passivity. To accept one's fate without murmuring does not pledge one to make no effort to better it. Knowing the power of concentrated thought, the initiate makes use of it in all the problems of life. His method, however, is not that of direct attack in which he wills the change of the unpleasant condition, but is directed to bring about certain changes in his own consciousness. For he knows that it is his own temperament which is the real instrument of karma. It is only through those factors in his own nature which react that karma can affect him. He knows that certain conditions come to him in order that they may provoke certain reactions in his own nature, and according to his handling of these reactions will be his karma, even in the present life. When he has harmonized these reactions, he has worked out his karma. He knows, therefore, that although he cannot determine the conditions under which his life must be lived, he can determine his reaction to those conditions. It is this fact which he bears constantly in mind in all his dealings. It is this realization which enables him to raise his head above a sea of troubles and view them from the standpoint of cosmic law and spiritual principles. Although he cannot command the conditions to which he awakens from the sleep of birth, he is nevertheless the master of his fate. For he can manipulate those conditions in such a way that they shall bear him whithersoever he will. Just as a ship can tack against a head wind, and the worse the conditions and the stronger the wind, the swifter his progress. The initiate is always revaluing things according to cosmic principles. He knows that his real life is lived in his higher self, the unit of evolution, and that this human personality is but a phase of his life, and that his real existence is never immediately involved in it. From the experiences of this phase he derives the food whereby his real self grows through the vast eons of evolutionary time. To him, it is his real self that matters, not his series of transitory personalities. And so he dares to take risks with his mundane prospects which most men would not dare to take. Consequently, although he may not amass the things of this world, his life has a significance, a richness, and a freedom which are lacking to the man who dares not so adventure lest he lose his all. The initiate lives gloriously because he lives dangerously. Nevertheless, his risks are more apparent than real, as were the risks of Columbus, who staked his success on a mathematical hypothesis. He depended for his safety upon the truth of the theory that the earth was round, if, as most people believed, it was flat and at the world's end was the precipice of outer space. He would never return from his great adventure of sailing towards the west in order to reach the east. So it is with the initiate. He dares to trust his fate to an esoteric theory. If, as the average man believes, he is wrong, he has made ducks and drakes of his life. But if, as he believes, he is right, he will find the Indies. What is the testimony of experience on this point? How many men who have served Mammon in his house of flesh have not recanted on their deathbeds? For when they come to die they know that they have never lived. Yet the initiate goes to meet the King of Terrors as to a crowning, for to him death is not the end of the world, but the Northwest Passage. Chapter 7, A Ground Plan of Illuminism. When we are considering such a vast and ramifying subject as the supernormal sciences, some schematic classification is necessary, for they range from psychism to ceremonial magic, and from the mystic's divine union to pacts with non-human entities, who may or may not be the devil. Our first task in such an undertaking should be to mark off our ground and differentiate it from the subject matter of natural science and the ordinary workaday world. This is no easy task, for no hard and fast line can be drawn. Who shall say when shrewdness becomes intuition, and intuition becomes vision? Neither can we satisfactorily leave to natural science the physical plane and the observations that are made through the five physical senses, for the unseen, which is the acknowledged subject matter of esoteric science, interpenetrates the material plane as intimately as water interpenetrates the strata of the earth. The nearest approach to accuracy may be to say that occult science begins where natural science ends. This unquestionably is true as far as it goes, and is a useful practical definition, but, unfortunately, the boundary line, though clearly marked, is not fixed, but resembles rather the line of demarcation between land and sea on a falling tide. Esoteric science must be distinguished from natural science by method rather than by subject matter. It starts from first principles on the spiritual plane, and works downwards, through mind, into matter. Whereas natural science starts from the observation of phenomena on the physical plane, and may give on as many aeons as esoteric science has required for its development, which cannot justly be denied it eventually work upwards through mind into spirit. Natural science starts with data, and deduces therefrom the principles that explain them. Esoteric science starts with principles and looks for the phenomena which may be expected to ensue. The one is laboriously working out the correlation of units into an organic whole, the other is equally laboriously exploring the ramifications of primary principles. In the one, experiment must precede knowledge, in the other, knowledge must precede experiment. But although it is impossible to plot on a map the exact line of demarcation between land and sea, nevertheless, no one standing on the seashore would have any difficulty in seeing it. So, although the clear-cut separation of exoteric from esoteric science is a thankless task, nevertheless, it is possible to indicate by a single word that which all its students will recognize as being the pursuit in which they are engaged. What, then, shall this single word be? It must be a word whose significance shall indicate the subject under consideration, but which shall not have been appropriated to the description of a partial aspect of that subject. Occultism will not do because it excludes the mystic, and mysticism will not do because it excludes the occultist. Neither is spiritualism a suitable term, for it has its definite connotation as signifying a particular aspect and method in these studies, and cannot conveniently be extended without causing confusion. Our subject is altogether in a parlous condition as regards nomenclature, burdened on the one hand with the Sanskrit terminology which has been wrenched from its original significance by the usages of modern theosophy, and on the other by a barbarous jargon derived partly from the mysteries of Greece, partly from the Kabbalism of Israel, and partly from medieval alchemy, which employed bastard Latin to conceal its thoughts. Two other sources of illumination are also available, and throw much additional light on our subject: the voluminous literature of Christian mysticism, and the equally prolific analytical school of psychology, to these we might perhaps add modern physics, whose findings are increasingly confirming what has hitherto been the exclusive preserve of occult cosmogony. Each of these schools of thought has its own terminology and its own system of classification, and some effort must be made in the near future to correlate them all if esoteric science is to come into its own. In the limited scope of these pages, no such attempt can be made, and indeed it is a work requiring the cooperation of specialists rather than the necessarily generalized knowledge of a single mind. We may clear the ground by a preliminary survey, showing the subdivisions into which superphysical science naturally falls. None of these, however, are watertight compartments. For the pursuit of any one of them, a generalized knowledge of several others is essential, and although specialization is as necessary in this pursuit as in any other if any high degree of achievement is to be reached, yet that specialization should include a sound general knowledge of the whole subject, so that the work of other specialists may be appreciated and their special gifts utilized as occasion requires. Since we have discarded the word occultism as a generic title for the field of our studies, we must endeavor to replace it by another. Our choice is limited, for the word chosen, as we have already seen, must convey an adequate mental picture to the outsider who looks up its meaning in a dictionary, and must not have been appropriated by any specialized school. In its essence, the whole subject under consideration is the extension of consciousness to planes of experience which are not available for the physical senses, and out of that extended experience comes the whole gamut of supernormal experience. Might we not agree, then, to denominate the whole field by the term Illuminism and to subdivide it primarily into two branches, mysticism and occultism? Into these two divisions it will be found that all the different transcendental movements can be assigned as their affinities lean towards the one or the other. Let us now define further what we mean by these two terms. Mysticism aims at the speediest possible attainment of the divine union of the soul with its source. In order to achieve this, it eliminates all that causes separation. A cardinal doctrine in all mystic schools is that of unreality. Whenever we find a school of thought which distinguishes sharply between the unreal and the real, and seeks to eliminate the former from consciousness in order to possess the latter, we shall be justified in classifying it as an essentially mystical system. Occultism, on the other hand, accepts the phenomenal as actual enough if not real, if we use the term real, in its technical mystical sense as eternal and self-existing. The aim of the occultist is to organize and master phenomena and bring them into harmony with the eternal law of the real. The mystic discards the phenomenal universe and endeavors to escape into the real. The occultist, even after he has glimpsed the real, stops on in the world of phenomena and endeavors to bring it under the control of his will. The occultist, while he agrees theoretically with the mystic's proposition, prefers the terms eternal and temporal to real and unreal, for he maintains a thing may be theoretically unreal, yet actually very much in evidence in all practical calculations made in time and space. To this the mystic replies that the soul is best freed from the temporal by accustoming it to think of everything except the eternal as unreal. In this controversy between occultism and mysticism, one is reminded of the story of the bishop who visited the Sunday school, and addressing the pupils, said, "I suppose all you little boys and girls want to go to heaven?" comma and waited amid an embarrassing silence till a little voice piped up with the unexpected, but very sound answer, "Well, not yet." We might liken these rival schools of thought to two colonists, the one of whom escapes from the problems of residence in a tropical and savage land by taking ship and going home, leaving unsolved problems which do not directly concern him, while the other remains on and fights the tribes and builds roads and brings the ground under cultivation. In politics, the one is an individualist and the other an imperialist; in religion, the one is a mystic and the other an occultist. There is much to be said for both points of view. Unfortunately, the difference between occultists and mystics are apparently irreconcilable, because they are a matter of temperament. Like the knights in the old story, they are fighting over a black and white shield, each seeing his side of it and no other. To argue with either of the combatants is a waste of time, Let us see rather how this twofold classification can be used to correlate the different transcendental movements and show their relationship one to another. We are quite aware that each one of them claims to have received its teaching direct from God, and heartily damns all the rest, especially such of the rest as are closest akin to it. But the unprejudiced onlooker, knowing something of the workings of the human mind, may perhaps be able to trace sources of inspiration. To say this is not to belittle the message which each founder of a school of thought may have brought to mankind. No man's work is lessened by showing its derivations, for all work must necessarily be derivative at this late day of human history. Everybody is indebted to his predecessors, and it is only the egoistic or the ignorant who refuse to acknowledge it. According to our classification as already defined, we would assign such religions as Buddhism and Christianity to the mystic path, together with such secondary movements as Christian Science of New Thought and higher thought schools which have sprung up like saplings from its root. To the occult path we would assign such religions as Hinduism and Kabbalistic Judaism, also such derivative movements as Theosophy, Alchemy, and Spiritualism. Such a classification must be taken rather as an attempt to clarify understanding by examples than to be exhaustive. Probably few of those thus assigned will agree as to their inclusion in any classification, it being a peculiarity of inspired organizations to want to be regarded as a special creation, and their works as miraculous. But the unprejudiced onlooker, if there is such a creature, sees them all as specimens in the natural history of the human mind. Still less, we fear, will the examples we have cited like the company to which they have been assigned. Rather will the lion lie down with the lamb than Christian Science and New Thought, or Theosophy and Spiritualism agree to be bedfellows. Nevertheless, the root ideas of Alofthem are not original, and can be traced back through many different enunciations into remote antiquity, as Blavatsky has so convincingly shown. Having made our primary division, let us now seek a further classification which shall enable us to understand the different tendencies of these two different paths. In mysticism, whose method of approach is by feeling, rather than by knowing, we find two broad divisions into nature mystics and spiritual mystics. The nature mystics we may most conveniently denominate pantheists, for they see the manifestation of God in nature, and seek union with him through a return to nature. Of these are such of the ancients who sought identification by ritual and invocation with natural forces, and of the moderns, such thinkers as Walt Whitman and Algernon Blackwood. The pantheists we may further subdivide into the beauty and the power schools. The beauty school, of which Walt Whitman is an example, contact nature by their love of her beauty, and never employ any ritual. The power school, whose viewpoint is so well expressed in the works of Algernon Blackwood, seek to share in the functions of natural forces, and invariably use some form of ritual, using the word in its broadest sense as actions intended to be symbolic, in order to achieve their aim. In the training and work of an initiate, the religious school of mysticism seeks its God apart from nature, and desires to know him direct, at first intention, as it were, and deprecates all secondary expressions as idolatry. This school may again be subdivided into the path of service and the path of contemplation. The Salvation Army is upon the path of service, and the Carmelite Order upon the path of contemplation. The Christian Science movement, to which we have already referred in connection with mysticism, is somewhat difficult to classify at first sight, for it effects service through contemplation, and moreover contains a considerable admixture of occult practice, if not of occult principle. We may, however, most expediently assign it to the path of service, for it is ascent to L1 via way of redemption through works. Chapter 8, A Ground Plan of Illuminism, Part 2. Occultism differs from mysticism in that it makes no attempt at any direct or immediate approach to its goal, but rather seeks to establish a graded way to the divine union which it recognizes, equally with mysticism, as the ultimate goal of evolution. Working from this standpoint, it neither condemns nor disregards the material conditions in which we find ourselves, but accepts them as part of the soul's discipline and proceeds to study them, first, with a view to harmonizing the soul with its environment, and, secondly, with a view to exercising a controlling, or at least modifying, influence over that environment.